jubeos plagi cantvaris liberare mans.
Nobilis humilis manie martir stabilis habilis utilis comes serva carnis fragilis mole possitos.
Hi, I'm Stan Brakhage, and today I'd like to finish up playing the Aeolus section of from the great book Ulysses by James Joyce, which got cut off on the test of time last week. You know, I sit here in this booth at KAIR at the University of Colorado where these tapes are made. I sit in here with Joe Chodosh bouncing about among cartridges and recordings, records and tapes and performing all kinds of engineering miracles in this tiny little room that comes sometimes to feel like a globe in a Hieronymus Bosch painting with blue sparks creeping up the walls. Often with Don Yanacito sitting here watching the clock along with the rest of us, pressured by time, and that's another kind of test of it. And so I don't often get to finish what I started. But it's just as well, because I'd like to present James Joyce to you outside of context. I mean, I used him last week rather shamelessly in a kind of context of criticism. That whole section from his book Ulysses, which really deals with a mix of voices critiquing, as he imagined it, ancient Egypt critiquing the Jewish people and saying, why don't you join us? Why don't you change your ways? We're so mighty and we're so powerful. Well, it made a good usage in that sense, and I like contexts. I mean, my main incentive for doing this is to share with you these treasures to me of recorded poets and out-of-print recordings and tapes that I've collected over the years of conversations. And I do like to string them almost like along a line of context of some sort or other, just to hold them together so they're more memorable. But today the context is maybe patch-up, and I'd like to free James Joyce for you in that reedy little voice of his, that Irish lilt, that music of his language, recorded in 1924 in his master's voice studio in Paris. A voice so extraordinarily out of the past, to some extent buried under scratches of the recording and the ordinary hiss of recording of the times. But still, maybe you can almost hear the music better in the sense that it's free to be a music. And that's the greatness of any poet, any great writer. Or maybe also to give a little sense of his autobiography. I mean, this is a man who put himself into exile, who cut himself off from the greatness of a great period of Irish literature, went into exile in Switzerland, finally settled in Paris, a man like a fawn in his build, but going blind, struggling with his eyes, so it must have been hard for him to read his own text and make a recording of it, and to bring him alive as a human being in that sense. What he's saying is he's imagining Egypt in the form of a lecturer, recreating Egypt for you, attacking the Jewish people for not joining the great power. Well, of course, I mean, he had his reasons. He could identify with those Jewish people in the sense that he was a man that so much had to reject the known powers and ways of his time that on his mother's deathbed, for instance, she pleaded with him to accept religion. And he could not make himself be hypocritical to satisfy her, even at her death, an agony for him, of course, and guilt that haunted him all his life. But here is maybe some of the reason. Quote, "A dumb belch of hunger cleft his speech. He lifted his voice above it boldly and then said, quote, But ladies and gentlemen, had the youthful Moses listened to and accepted that view of life, had he bowed his head and bowed his will and bowed his spirit before that arrogant admonition, he would never have brought the chosen people out of their house of bondage, nor followed the pillar of the cloud by day. He would never have spoken with the Eternal amid lightnings on Sinai's mountaintop, nor ever have come down with the light of inspiration shining in his countenance and bearing in his arms the tables of the law, graven in the language of the outlaw." He ceased and looked at them, enjoying silence. So now that I've given you the English of it, here's the Irish music of it, James Joyce himself.
A dumb belch of hunger cleft his speech. He lifted his voice above it boldly. But, ladies and gentlemen, had the youthful Moses listened to and accepted that view of life? Had he bowed his head and bowed his will and bowed his spirit before that arrogant admonition? He would never have led the chosen people out of their house of bondage, nor followed the pillar of the cloud by day. He would never have spoken with the Eternal on Sinai's mountain top, nor ever have come down with the light of inspiration shining in his countenance and bearing in his arms the tables of the law, graven in the language of the outlaw.
And so James Joyce had to follow his muse instead in order to give us this extraordinary life's work of writing, which, well, there's just nothing to compare to it. It's tough and hard to read. Certainly most people find Finnegan's Wake impossible, but I don't, because I always start with just the music, the beautiful sounds of it, and then let whatever it is that will come to me arise from that. Following his muse, he came to a whole new possibility of language. Following James Broughton, following his muse, came to a whole making it new of old kinds of language and old ways of thinking in poetics. You know, when I introduced him several programs back, I really, again, pressured by time. I mean, we're boxed into this room with 26 minutes. Pressured by that time, I just barely had introduced him in the sense of how he comes on to people tactily, needing to touch not just people, but everything in the world, and maybe gave you an affrighted and imbalanced picture of him. That's also his strength of creativity. And his loveliness, his power, in a sense. James Broughton, I cannot imagine making a creation of the world in which one figure reaches out a single finger to touch that of another, as is Michelangelo's, and maybe too much the rest of us sense the Renaissance and the Sistine Ceiling sense of it. That Christian hesitancy that's inhibited. Broughton really must feel, in the most earthy sense, whatever it is he's chanting about. So when he talks about a visit from three muses, on the one hand, he really means it. I mean, these muses are as he knew them in his childhood, as any child might know them, dancing through the chicken yard. and at the same time, they are. All of that power and majesty of inspiration which makes his poetry and anybody's possible. A visit from Three Muses by James Broughton.
I was out in the chicken yard minding the hen coop, sitting there hard on my daily predicament, which is hatching new tunes from my unfinished songbook, and having on the whole a rather uninspiring time, when lo and behold me, three tall women came dancing through the chicken yard, right across the chicken mash, three peachier graces you never saw painted. Now, I'm a simple type fellow with complicated dreams. I've had a lot of visions and met some grand people, but these unexpected visitors were as real as a clock. My name is Fay Morgan, said the one in gold. My name is Kitty Hawk, said the one in blue. My name is Ruby Hill, said the one in red. We're your three muses, they said in unison, and we've come to be amused. I stood on my head and blew my rusty trumpet. I tried an old cantata, but I'd lost my pitch pipe. I'm sorry, girls, said I. Things haven't been moving. All I have is a predicament that's unpredictable. You deserve a better fate, said they. Of course, but what is it, said I. We're it, said the three. Well, who works it, said I. Oh, you do, said Ruby. With me, said Kitty. With us, said Fay. Then you're hired, said I. Fay Morgan put a vibrator on my head. Kitty Hawk drove a corkscrew into my heart. Ruby Hill made sure my genitals were on, and she tickled the soles of my feet. Light-footed, said she. Light-hearted, said Kitty. Light-headed, said Fay. Illuminations, quoth I, and we did a quick quadrille right between the hens. What keeps it moving, said I. Keeping it in motion, said they. Move things around, keep them moving, move them to the right place at the right time. Adventure, not predicament, said that trio three times. Let's advent, said I, and we formed a glee club ring around the rooster. Then they tossed my questions into the air, tucked the answers into their bosoms, and said they would start full time tomorrow. I'll be there to wake you, said Fay Morgan. I'm your non-stop stewardess, said Kitty Hawk. I'll welcome you home, said Ruby Hill. And away they skipped, as sudden as they came. Well, if I'm not a changed man, I soon will be, with three new roommates for my single bed. No more stray feathers. I've met my own flock. I can stay in one place, moving everything around. So if you need a good muse on your own predicament, go sit in your chicken yard and see what comes out.
And so that you don't imagine that that's just invented delightfully in a moment of freedom from worry and struggle, James Broughton really comes to make that poem at a time when he'd had a continuous headache for a long time, was facing a terrible mid-age crisis, and then finally had almost been killed while hiking along the cliffs by the sea slipping, some sand slipping from under him and his hanging by roots from sheer annihilation, holding on to these plants until someone came along to help him up. And he was blocked in his writing. And this is how he, a modern living man, brought the muse alive in him again. The muse, which we usually think of as something wispy and distant and Greek or some such, having very little to do with us unless we make reference to the Greeks or some such, available to anyone. Just in the immediate environment. You see, also one of my impulses is to make these people human. I think art's been removed from so many people's lives because they're caught up in some hatred of the great man or great woman syndrome, or think of it as an activity ivory tower-like. And really, the chicken yard is the more clear ground. For instance, you'd think there's no piece of music in the world that's thought of in loftier, more exalted and removed from daily activities form than Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, a pinnacle of musical achievement. Well, I want to present a form of it that I hope will wipe out all that and make it hearable again. And out of an impulse that began with Franz Liszt, wished simply to share this wonderful piece of music created by this Viennese man, Beethoven, who hadn't been so terribly dipped in bronze yet. He wanted to share this great music with people that could not afford to go to concert halls, the peasants, in fact, or country people, farmers, and so on. And he made tours to small towns, the provinces, in order to play his own music and share with them. But how to share with them a whole symphony? Well, the drive was so strong in him that he sat down and transcribed Beethoven's Fifth for piano so that he could play it. And then, several years ago, Glenn Gould, tortured in his own way by concert hall audiences and wishing never to have to sit in front of them again, but deciding to spend the rest of his life making recordings so that people could listen to them in the comfort of their homes, in their daily lives, picked up Franz Liszt's transcription for piano of Beethoven's Fifth, and I'm going to give you the whole first movement of it.
Thank you.
am, by the way, not trying to bring these voices and this music, which in this last case has become too familiar to hear freshly in most forms. I'm not trying to bring these voices and these poets down to earth in some sense so that you care more about them, or even so that I do, but more to inspire some confidence to reach out to one's neighbor, or finally even oneself, to make it daily some way and not have it removed and lofty, as I feel has killed interest in the arts in so many people. Hardest of all is to appreciate or give any expression to or for the people that you really know. I mean, I could talk easily for hours about people I've read about in books, but when I begin to describe a friend like James Broughton, or most of the people I've shown on here, well, for example, the first time I met the composer Carl Ruggles, I had been for so many years using his name in combination with Charles Ives that I called him Charlie, and I did on one of these programs. Ed Dorn lives in this town, and I see him almost weekly, and he and Jenny, by the way, put out one of the only newspaper that I care to read from cover to cover, Rolling Stock. And how to describe him? Well, he tackled the problem. He showed how you can get the clearest portraits of people by their very enemies, the white people coming in contact with the Apaches, if you just carefully select certain quotes. And here's a whole poem made of them.
Assorted compliments. A treacherous, fiendish look. Bartlett. Some have a Chinese cast of countenance. Smart. More miserable-looking objects I never beheld. Fremont. Coal-black eyes. Peters. Physically of slighter build than any Indians I have seen. Clum. Geronimo is the worst Indian who ever lived. General Miles. Tall, majestic in figure, muscular. Brant's mare. Fine physical conformation, foot. They live entirely by the chase, Delgado. Slim, very agile, features emotionless, flat, hair not unlike bristles, Bancroft. La Carne del Caballo, Velasco. They are said to be more fond of the meat of the mule than that of any other animal, Greg.
Okay, so I'll not dodge the issue. I'll make my first attempt to give a description of Ed Dorn, with whom I'm most familiar. If I were going to make a film of President Jackson, it is his visage and movement and power and grace that would encourage me to do it, and maybe with balance. And now we're out of time again, and we end on Charles Ives, The New River.